Back again to badquaker.com podcast. Today is September 18th, 2012. It's a Tuesday, and this is podcast number 207. My name is Ben Stone, and I have a special treat today. Minno Troyer is going to be with me on the podcast. What you're going to hear is a telephone interview that I did with Minno today. And Minno, well, I'll just let Minno speak for himself. Here's the interview.
With me today is a special guest from New Hampshire, Minno Troyer. And Minno was called by Dave Ridley one of the trespassive 12. He was arrested for trespassing on so-called public property. I'm not sure exactly how you can trespass. If we believe the government's story that there is such a thing as public property, I'm not exactly sure how we can justify a trespassing charge on public property. But Minno is with us, and Minno, thanks for coming on the show with me. Welcome to badquaker.com. And how about if you tell us how it is possible to be arrested for trespassing on public property?
Well, that's a good question, actually. I agree with you. It's public property. It's funded by taxpayer money, so to me that means that the public should have access to it. And as a matter of fact, we were arrested in the parking lot of the jail as we were preparing to leave. We were just getting ready to get in our cars and leave, and the police came into the parking lot and arrested us. But the claim was that we had been ordered to leave and we refused to leave, and that was not true. Supposedly one of the jail employees muttered that if we don't leave, he's going to call the cops, but he didn't make sure that people could hear it, and most of us were so far away, there's no way we could hear it. One of the participants in the demonstration announced to the rest of the group that we have been ordered to leave. He announced it over the megaphone, but to me that was not a lawful order. And so I was waiting for the lawful order to leave. I was waiting for the jail employees or the police to come and tell us straight up, leave, and I was prepared to leave. But that never happened.
And that is typically how the police would handle a situation where they want
Absolutely.
You to leave. They will
Absolutely.
Come out and say it. Yeah.
Yeah. Anytime in order for a trespassing charge to stick, you're supposed to have been told to leave.
Yeah. Now, why were you guys at the jail to begin with?
We were doing a demonstration, which is a victimless crime demonstration. We had a friend of ours was in the jail, Russell Canning, so we were showing support for him, but also just in general, all the people in the jail that are there for victimless crimes, such as owning a plant or whatever. And we were, at one point there was up to about 60 people, I believe, and we walked around the jail, and some people were holding signs, and some people were chanting, but, I mean, that's all it was.
But now no property was damaged, there was nothing, there was no vandalism of any kind?
No, absolutely not.
And were you eventually convicted on that, or what happened?
No, I was acquitted. I was the only one that was acquitted out of the 12. And that was, in my opinion, probably because of the judge that I was lucky enough to have. There was a visiting judge, and the rest of them all got the local judge that has it clearly in for free staters.
Was that Burke?
mine wasn't Burke. The rest of them had Burke.
Ah. Burke is the legendary Free Stater-hating judge in Keene, New Hampshire.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think I would have stood a chance at all with him. But this was a visiting judge that was sitting in for Burke at the time.
I always find it odd, you know, some people really have a lot of trust in the so-called justice system, but if you just think about how arbitrary it is that one judge can decide in one way and another judge decides on exactly the same case in a totally different way, and somehow we're supposed to believe that's justice.
Yeah, absolutely, and not only that, but the fact that if you have the state bring a case against you, and then it's the state that gets to be the final arbiter. I mean, that's not a conflict of interest. I mean, come on.
The blatant, you know, the obvious contradiction there to call that justice, it's so Orwellian. I just don't know how people don't see that.
Absolutely.
Do you know what the other people were eventually, what their punishment, do you know what their punishment ended up being in that?
Only vaguely. I don't know all the specifics. What I do know is that they were convicted over a range of crime, of levels of crime. Like, I think some of them were convicted of misdemeanor, and some of them had the charges dropped to a, what do they call that? It's lower than a misdemeanor. It doesn't go on your record.
Hmm.
Just a violation, or that's not what they call it. I forget what they call it. But they all, I believe, had to end up paying a fine or something like community service. And there was a bail condition of staying away from the jail for 1 year.
Hmm. So, again, they're commanding you to stay off of what they call public property.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, totally.
It's a funny thing. First off, they don't want to admit that they're socialists. People who believe in things like public property don't want to admit that they're actually believing a socialist concept when they do that. But then when they do believe in this so-called public property, and then they assign weird rules to it that violate the very principles that they've established as being real, it's very weird.
Exactly, and especially considering that we're not doing any damage to the public property, we weren't doing anything except expressing our grievances. And there's one other thing that factors in as well that's very important to note, is that was the first time that we had done a demonstration at the new jail location, but there had been numerous demonstrations at the previous location in Westmoreland. And there had never been any trouble. And now all of a sudden, boom, they're right on top of us.
It's really strange, again, that there's no continuity. There's no, you know, law is whatever they decided to be today, and tomorrow it's going to be whatever they decide tomorrow.
Exactly. It's like, it's as if they decided they're going to change the rules with the new location. They're going to get it, I guess, tighter under their control, I suppose.
Now, you're part of the Free State Project in New Hampshire, right?
I'm a participant, yes.
You were, if I recall, you were one of the very early members.
Yeah, I moved in June of 2007.
Now, what brought you back to my attention, because I remember when this happened with the with Dave Ridley reporting on the Trespassive 12, but what brought you back into my mind was this article you wrote for the Dollar Vigilante, and I really enjoyed that. I want to read just a couple little sections out of it, because I want to encourage listeners to get over to badquaker.com and hit the link that takes you to Dollar Vigilante, to this article, because it's really a good article. But I want to read a couple little sections of it here. It says, the fact is that freedom is not a condition of society. Public freedom is every bit as absurd as public rights or public property. And that kind of goes to what we were just talking about there. You know, the acceptance, and this might seem offensive to even some people in the liberty movement, but the acceptance of the idea that something like public freedom or some kind of mutual freedom that we all that we all enjoy. All these things are concepts of socialism, and they're really contradictory to a lot of the aspects of liberty and libertarianism and so forth. Isn't that right?
Yes. Well, I consider it collectivism, and I use that term more broadly than it is usually used among libertarians. It's, collectivism is much broader than just believing in the collective sharing of property. It's the whole mindset of there being a greater whole than the individual. There isn't. There is sort of a montage effect or whatever of all these individuals interacting with each other, but there is no mind that controls the collective. The greatest whole is the individual, and that is a huge blind spot, I believe, in most people's minds, even libertarians.
So as you work these things out logically in your mind, there's really no way that you can have things like public rights or collective rights or public property in itself. The two words are counterintuitive. You can't have public property. Somebody has to own it.
Exactly.
And public is not somebody.
Exactly. And I think that it's important to have a clear definition of property to understand that. I like, the best definition I have ever come across for property is the one that was given by Andrew J. Galambos in the book Sicutur ad Astra, which is out of print today. But he said property, if I can recall it correctly here, I think he said property is volitional man's life and all derivatives of his life. So you own yourself. And everything that's derived from you, you own, because you're a volitional being. It is not possible for there to be some collective ownership where there's no, you know, ownership derived from an individual.
Hmm. Yeah, and from a different point of view, if you think of it as, say, well, you know, there's millions of acres of land in out west in the western states that is supposedly public land, and yet, and to a large extent, all of us are taxed against our will to pay certain maintenance fees on that land to fight forest fires or to, you know, to...
That's just aggression right there. That's all that is.
Yeah.
Nobody owns that, so why should somebody be forced to pay for it?
Exactly. And in the same sense, if someone did own it, then they would be responsible, and they would take responsibility because they have ownership in it. They would take responsibility to make sure it's protected.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and Galambos actually defined it further. He went on to point out that natural resources cannot of themselves be owned, but the use of them can be owned.
Mm-hmm.
So the first person to move in on a natural resource and make use of it, then adds value through his own labor and owns the use of that.
Yeah.
His position.
What he actually did there was he further refined what Locke had talked about and what Locke had established as true ownership of property.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I can't wrap my mind around how they can say that it's public property, and yet you can be arrested for being on it, even when you're not damaging anything, you're not threatening anyone, you're not harming anyone, and yet somehow these magic people with their costumes have the authority to say who can and can't be on that property. It just boggles
right.
My mind.
Yeah, it's clearly irrational, but I can understand how they come up with that. It begins with the irrational idea of a collective that is an actual whole, that is an actual organism, functioning organism, and it is not. It does not have a mind. It cannot make decisions. It is not an organism. And so, if you're going to have this. If you're going to imagine it as being an actual functioning organism, then you have to have an actual functioning organism that administers this make-believe organism of the collective,
mm-hmm.
and that is the government, the people in the government. So they're acting as the administrators of the public. And
yeah.
so you end up getting this imaginary entity known as the public or the collective, the people, pitted against the only real entity, which is the individual.
Yeah, and again, the conflict becomes property, because if the collective, as we're calling it, if the collective has the right to property, then it guarantees the individual has no right to property.
That's right, to that property, yep, exactly.
So in a very real sense, these two concepts cannot coexist in the same place at the same time, you know, logically speaking, because one guarantees that the other... because it's a property conflict, you can't have a collective which can own property and an individual which can own property. You can't have those in the same place at the same time.
Right. I agree. Yeah.
Now, you said in your article, the fallacy of public freedom paves the way for the other fallacy, collective emancipation, the absurd notion that freedom must or even could come about through the deliberate collaboration of a greater we. Whenever you hear someone say, we need to, or whatever, or if enough people, whatever, and I'm adding the whatevers, that's my part, relating to the quest for freedom, you are observing the fallacy of collective emancipation being propagated. And I think that's really good. I mean, Roderick Long, a couple of years ago, talked about a similar, he didn't say it in the same way, but he talked about a similar situation where if we could all just get together and vote in freedom, the very fact that we did that would annihilate the possibility of doing it.
Right, yeah. And it's just, you know, it comes back again to, it doesn't work simply because there is no actual functioning collective. The only functioning entity is the individual, and when the individual throws his resources toward this make-believe entity, it's just a waste because it doesn't change the outcome. If you really stop and think, do these actions change the outcome? Is the outcome going to be different whether I participate or do not participate? And if the answer is no, then how can that be anything but a waste of that individual's resources when those resources could be applied to something that would actually tangibly make that individual freer?
Now, that's an important point, and you talked about that in your article, too. I'll just create a scenario. Let's say you have you look at your home budget and you have $100 extra in your home budget, and you say, "Well, I really want to do something to help, you know, assure freedom in the future, or you know, I want to help the cause of liberty or whatever."
Right.
And then you take that money and you give it to some organization based in Washington D.C. that's going to lobby the government for freedom.
Right.
And you have just essentially thrown away $100 that you could have used in your own family to provide more liberty for yourselves and your family.
Absolutely, that's the point right there. That $100 is not gonna make the difference whether that organization accomplishes something or does not. It depends on what it's doing. Maybe every small increment makes a little change, but most of that stuff, it's not, $100 doesn't change the outcome.
Mm. And even if you could measure it out, because of the individual as opposed to this whole group in Washington, D.C., almost anything you do with $100 would be more productive than sending it to somebody else to waste it in Washington, D.C.
Right. Yes, that is true. There's probably going to be people that the first thing they think of is if everybody did this, which, again, goes right back to the collectivist mindset,
mm-hmm.
if everybody, you know, I'm not everybody. I have no influence over everybody. Why would I worry about what everybody does? You know, I can't do anything about that. But there's going to be people who are going to say, well, if everybody took this approach and just empowered themselves, then who would there be to keep the government in check? And the thing is, the way the free market works it rises to fill the demand of whatever's being demanded.
Exactly.
And if all those resources, if all those individuals who want freedom were actually directing their resources, their money, at things that actually empower themselves, and if there was this huge market for that kind of stuff, the government's power would just fade into the background, as the individual's power would rise up through the market rising to fill that demand. So there is some, you don't even have to feel guilty about empowering yourself, knowing that, well, if everybody did that, we'd actually have freedom. If you want to have the we mindset, we would have freedom if everybody did that.
That's an important point. I'm going to break for a commercial, and when we get back, we're going to come back to that, because that was the real thing in this article that just popped my ears up and made me say, I have got to get this guy on badquaker.com and talk to him, because this is something I've been talking about. So stick with us through the commercial. We'll be right back.
Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that'll be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much.
And welcome back to the show. With me is Menno Troyer from New Hampshire, and we're talking about his article over at the Dollar Vigilante, and you can find that if you go to badquaker.com, where our show notes are for today, and just follow that link over to the Dollar Vigilante, and it's a wonderful article. I suggest all the listeners get over there and read it. Menno, before the break, we were talking about something that I've talked about a lot on this podcast, and that is that the government does everything it can to try to control the market and try to manipulate the market and try to regulate the market. But when there's a market desire for something, the government is helpless to stop the market, because the market is one thing that is far more powerful than any government that's ever existed. And when there's...
I agree.
And when there's what you were talking about, that individual desire for liberty and freedom, when that really takes a hold in the hearts of people, there becomes a market for it, and the government is not capable of stopping that from happening.
Right, and if you look at it, the market has been rising to the demand, but the demand has been for this false idea of freedom, this collective emancipation, and so you've had things like the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street movement, and there's all kinds of stuff where people are throwing their resources collectively toward freedom, and they're not accomplishing much, because if you think about it, each person's resources count for so little in those kind of endeavors. If those same resources were being directed by each individual toward whatever empowers him the most, can you imagine what would happen when the market rises up to fill that demand?
Yeah. Now, you mentioned in the article that great story called iPencil. And that's kind of the point of that of that essay, is that, you know, the individual makers of the pencil, if you consider the guy that mines the natural resources, and somebody else that cuts down the wood, and somebody else that develops the paint, and somebody that harvests the rubber for the eraser, and there's that little piece of brass that holds the eraser, and all the different people involved in all the different aspects of this, they're not doing it to make a pencil.
Exactly. Right, and that would translate, in this regard, it would translate into all these individuals pursuing each their own freedom. They're not doing it in order to free the world, but that would be the effect that would happen.
Right, the unstoppable effect.
Yes, exactly.
And so, you know, as much as a person might appreciate someone like Ron Paul, and as much as a person might appreciate, you know, the intent of all those people who want to get out voting and do civil disobedience and, you know, protest, or even people, even the radicals that want an armed revolution, which, as counterproductive as I think that would be, all of their intentions might be good, but it doesn't matter what their intentions are when they attempt to move collectively like that to accomplish a goal. They're really going in the absolute opposite direction of what they think they're going.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's really no different than trying to centrally plan the economy. I mean, it just doesn't work. That's not natural.
It seems odd to me that people who are against central planning embrace trying to use central planning to obtain freedom.
Yes, it is. It really is. And it took me years to work through in my mind and reach that point where I really grasp how things really are. And now I'm starting to see that, you know, there's a lot of other people around me that have been reaching the same conclusions. So that's really encouraging, actually.
Let me read from your article one more time, because it's a part that's actually applying to what we're talking about here. It says, libertarians easily grasp how the phenomenon of a smoothly functioning and prosperous economy cannot result from central planning, yet astonishingly, most of them readily assume that the phenomenon of a freedom-supporting society must result from a deliberate collaborative effort to bring it about. In fact, just as a prosperous economy arises from individuals everywhere, each independently pursuing his or her own interests, think of iPencil, so the infrastructure of freedom can arise and become accepted as the norm only through individuals everywhere, each independently pursuing self-empowerment. There simply is no other way. And, man, that just strikes me in the heart when I read that, because that is so right on. I mean, that's just perfect.
Exactly.
And you said also, note that this is not some kind of phony self-empowerment promoted by some New Age or self-help guru. That's not what we're talking about here. It's not, because even that stuff folds into a collective theology at some
point.
Yeah,
exactly. Very much follow the leader type stuff, you know.
Yeah. I want to ask you also, you've got a quite an interesting personal story of how you came to the position that you're in Liberty and your thought patterns and so forth. What can you tell me about your life and background and everything?
Well, it's quite different from the norm. I grew up Amish. So grew up with horse and buggies and a deeply religious environment. But from an early age, I rejected the idea of external authority. I mean, the way that was described in the Amish is I was a rebellious child and a rebellious teenager. But that what that really meant is I rejected external authority and rules, I asserted myself. And so I did a lot of reading. This is a story I don't tell a lot of people, but I'm going to go ahead and put it out there. It's really kind of interesting. My father was a renegade in his own right, and he clashed with the Amish church, and he got kicked out of the church, and because he wouldn't go along with some of the things that the elders wanted him to do. And but he stayed Amish. Well, no, he didn't. Actually, before I was born, he spent a couple of years as a Mennonite, and he drove big rigs. But when I knew him, he was back to being Amish, just not a member of the church initially. But anyway, he had this idea that, well, he had raised six children with a previous wife who died, and he felt that they had been badly influenced by peers because he had raised them in a very large Amish community, and he felt like their peers had misled them. So he decided he's going to raise his seventh child right, and he moved me and my mother. I was an only child. My mother's only child, the only child in the family at that time. He moved us to a very remote location in Missouri so that he would have sole influence over me. And he wouldn't even let me, you know, interact with the neighbors or anything like that. And I didn't even have children my own age to interact with. And that backfired on him, because what that did is it gave me the ability to think for myself and figure my own things out. And I did a lot of reading, too. And he always grew a lot of vegetables to feed us every year. And he had the neighbors bring old newspapers and magazines and stack up a big pile of old magazines that he used for mulch in the garden. Well, I was so hungry for a window on the outside world that I would go and grab these magazines and go off and hide in the barn somewhere and read them. So I kind of got a feel for what was out there. I mean, besides the fact that I had social studies in school as well, and but it was a privately run Amish school. So, I mean, that's pretty much how I started out. I received my introduction to libertarian thinking through a book called The Neotech Discovery by Dr. Frank R. Wallace when I was 16 years old.
Hey, you know, it's often, I've talked to quite a few people about their childhood and so forth that have ended up in the Liberty Movement, and it's relatively common for them to be rebels of some kind or another.
And, oh, sure. Yes.
It's almost, I've quoted Frank Charteroff before, who said that really you don't convert libertarians, you just discover them.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's the natural state of the human being is to be independent and be self-led, but that's pretty much stamped out of children in their early childhood, and I think that there's only a certain portion of them that make it through with that at least partially intact.
Yeah, very true. Now, you when you became an adult, you left the Amish community, and as far as I know, you didn't turn back to that. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I left. Left when I was 20, and have been out ever since.
At this point, I think we're going to break for another commercial break, and when we come back, we'll talk some more with Menno Troyer.
Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you! BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to get set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee, and they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website, or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to BadQuaker.com and click on the button for HostGator. And thank you very much for supporting BadQuaker.com.
sticking with me through the break. And my name is Ben Stone. I'm back with Menno Troyer from New Hampshire and part of the Free State Project. And we were talking about, Menno, we were talking about your roots and your family being Amish, but you're not Amish anymore. You've left that behind. How would you consider yourself nowadays?
As far as?
Religiously speaking.
Well, I consider myself atheist, and I always qualify that with, I believe there's two different kinds of atheists. One of them I call the faith-based kind, and then there's the objective atheist, and I consider myself an objective atheist. The faith-based kind is the kind that says there is no God, end of story. They know for a fact there is no God. Well, that's just faith. Objective atheism has a basis for asserting that there is no reason to believe that there is a God, or at least not in the sense that he's generally projected, he or she or whatever is generally projected as being. I'll just cover real quick how I reached that, and just the quickest soundbite I can do. It's very bottom foundational axiom for that is the fact that existence exists. There is no way around that. There is no other way. Unless you were to accept the contradiction that existence does not exist. Okay? Existence exists. Now, in order for there to be a creator, he has to exist. And so he cannot have created existence. And I've had a Christian say to me, oh, well, you mean his own existence. Well, if he exists, then there is existence, period. You know, I'm not saying that there's not a creator that can create forms. I mean, man is a creator. Man creates, takes existence and turns it into other forms. Mm-hmm. But existence itself cannot be created. And then secondly, in order for there to be a creator, he has to be alive. And so that means life cannot have been created either. It is a constant of existence. And then finally, in order for there to be a creator, he has to be conscious. And so consciousness cannot have been created. It is also a constant of existence. So, actually, Einstein identified that there are two constants, matter and energy, and that there is a third constant, which is the controlling or unifying force in existence, and he could never quite identify that. So he died believing that the third constant is God. But Dr. Frank R. Wallace actually identified that third constant as consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes the most sense to me. And so on that basis, I do not believe that there is a God other than conscious beings throughout the universe, probably. But there's, to me, the odds of there being a God, as the Bible describes, is so infinitesimally small that it's not even worth considering. So on that basis, I call myself an atheist and not an agnostic.
Mm-hmm. But on the same effect, if someone had a magic box they could open and show you the logical, if there were a logical fallacy in what you're saying, if someone had a magic box they could open and show it to you, then you would say, okay, well, as long as there's no fallacy, then that seems plausible.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, that is one of my biggest passions, and I do distance myself from people who are intellectually dishonest. One of my biggest passions is intellectual honesty, and that means that in the formation of one's beliefs, one is always loyal to honesty and never to one's belief system.
Right. So, and if theists could take on that same principle of honesty, then you would have to be put in a position to say, as a theist, you would have to say, okay, So if I can follow a logical pattern of thought and come up with a conclusion that there can be no God, or there can be no creator, or there can be no original conscious, or however you want to look at it, then the honest theist would have to come to that conclusion as well.
Oh, absolutely. I don't see how they could otherwise, or could not come to that conclusion. To me, see, the Christians kind of get around the whole existence exists thing with, well, God always existed. And to me, it's like, well, then that's an unnecessary link. If God, if you can conceive that a creator that is so complex and so majestic as to have created the entire extremely complex, majestic universe, that creator could be eternal and have always existed and always will, then how can you not just accept that existence is eternal?
Mm.
You know, it does not, that's just an extra link, and Occam's razor, you know, kind of cuts that out.
Yeah. Yeah, you take away anything that's unnecessary in the equation.
Yes, exactly. Unless it's proven that it's necessary, you know. That...
Let's jump back to our, before we lose half our audience here, because of you and I going off on something that's interesting to us and maybe seven other people among the 5,000 listeners. But going back to your article, your last line in it really, really grabbed me. It says, nothing could be, sorry about that. It says, nothing could be, I'm messing it up again. Nothing could possibly be more gratifying to the parasitic elite than watching those who yearn for freedom waste their precious resources on impotent endeavors and encouraging others to do the same. And then you ask the question, are you playing into their hand?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real thump on the chest to...
Mm-hmm. And, yes.
Go ahead.
And by the way, I hope the tone of the article did not come across as slamming libertarians. All I'm trying to do is point something out and open their eyes, because I have nothing but respect for people who are out there and actively engaged in the quest for freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have much more respect for those people than people who just are like a dog laying on a nail, just whimpering but not getting up. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But, so all I was trying to do is just point out, you know, how they're inadvertently misdirecting their resources.
Yeah. Oh, I took it in a very good tone. I really appreciated the article when I read it. I enjoyed it tremendously. I linked to it in Facebook and told people, this is what I've been trying to say.
Awesome. Awesome.
But I think maybe your words were a little more eloquent than mine. I end up going off into different tangents and different directions and missing my own point sometimes. But I really enjoyed the article.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I like to ask all my guests one version or another of this question and just see what you think. If you project ahead, thinking of the current government and the United States as we know it, and you think of what things may or may not be like in the next 50 or 100 years, and the existence of the greater state worldwide, how do you see things unfolding in 50, 100 years or further?
Well, that's... I don't know if there's anybody alive that can project out that far. Even Ray Kurzweil, one of the best people at projecting trends, does not go much beyond 30 years. But I would certainly hope and tentatively expect that the state will be a thing of the past by then. I think that mankind is evolving fast enough for that to be a very real possibility. I do believe that there is a trend toward a unified world state, and unlike a lot of people who see that as a bad thing, I think that that's just the natural culmination of this trend.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good thing, because guess what? This beast, this parasitic beast, is just going to keep growing and growing until there's something that stops it from growing, and then it has to collapse. And once there's this unified world government, it can't get any bigger.
Yeah. It can only begin consuming itself.
Exactly. And so I think that's where the reset may occur, but it's hard to say.
Yeah. Boy, it's like I have said that in a different variation so many different times, that this is not like a tinfoil hat conspiracy thing, you know, the one world government
right.
is out to get us. It's just a logical progression.
Right. Exactly. Yep.
And if we consider that the state really is only, in its current form, it's only about 100 years old, but even in any form, it's only about 10, 15,000 years old, very maximum. So this is a weird anomaly in the progress of humanity.
True, absolutely, yeah.
Well, Minnow, I really appreciate you coming on the show with me and sharing your thoughts on this.
I really appreciate you having me.
It was really refreshing to find your article, and I knew the name, and so I had to go back and re-listen to the old Ridley reports and.
Oh, really?
It was pretty cool going back and listening to that stuff.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I wasn't even aware that I had been mentioned by Ridley.
Oh, yeah. do you ever get out to, like, the Pork Fests or anything like that?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. I didn't make it to Pork Fest this year because I was actually abroad getting a foreign permanent residency completed.
Ah.
But I usually try to make it to Pork Fest, yep.
My first
experience with New Hampshire was Pork Fest 2006.
Ah. We're going to make every effort to try to get to Pork Fest next year. Of course, nobody
awesome.
Controls the future, so who knows what will happen. But if you see us there, if you happen to make it, and if we happen to make it, be sure and look me up and let me know.
Definitely, I will.
I'd love to meet you in real life and shake your hand and so forth. Well, Minnow, thanks for coming on the show with me, and thanks for all you're doing, because even though what you're doing is for you, what you're doing is also helping me. So,
yeah.
So thanks a lot.
That's the whole point. That's the whole point is to build value-based relationships one-on-one with people.
Yeah. Yep. So. Thank you very much.
Right.
And hopefully I'll get you back on the show at Pork Fest 2013.
Hey, that sounds great.
Okay. Thanks, Minnow.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
And it was really great to have Minnow on the podcast with me today. And it was a lot of fun talking to Minnow. And I do hope that I can see him at Pork Fest 2013. I hope all goes well for him, and I hope we, myself and my wife, and maybe some of the others here at BadQuaker.com are able to get out there to Pork Fest in 2013. It's something we're really looking forward to. And let me just encourage you, whoever listening, wherever you are in the world, if you can make it to New Hampshire next summer for the Pork Fest, it's really a lot of fun. My wife didn't get to make it in 2012, but both of my daughters and one of the other staff here at BadQuaker.com were able to make it out, and we had a lot of fun at Pork Fest. So let's just make this a little commercial for Pork Fest 2013. It's really well worth it, and again, hopefully I'll see Minnow there, and hopefully I'll be able to do a follow-up interview at Pork Fest 2013 with not only Minnow Troyer, but a bunch of the other people that I met at Pork Fest 2012. So in the meantime, for more on liberty, the Zero Aggression Principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com, and thank you very much for listening today. Goodbye.